Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to our afternoon session, the Elmer B. Statz Lecture, titled The Future of Work. As many of you know, Elmer B. Statz was one of the founders of the Academy back in 1967. He worked with the Office of the Bureau of the Budget under five presidents, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. And he was the fifth Comptroller General of the U.S. from 1966 to 1981. Elmer Statz passed sadly in 2011, and this lecture honors his long-term commitment to public administration. And in fact, yesterday we rededicated the Statz Conference Room to his legacy. So this is a nice way to continue remembering his legacy and all the contributions he made to public administration. So normally for this lecture, we have one single person. But this time, we have a panel. We have a wonderful panel who's going to be talking to us about the future of work. So I'm going to take a minute to introduce our panel and then turn it over. We have Jennifer Polka, founder and executive director of Code for America. She served as the U.S. Deputy Chief Technology Officer in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy from 2013 to 2014, where she architected and helped found the United States Digital Service. She's a graduate of Yale University and lives in Oakland, California, with her daughter, husband, and seven chickens. I had to say that.
Six now.
Fantastic. Thank you for being here. Thanks a lot for being here. Beth Colbert. Beth, thank you so much. Is Chief Executive Officer of Skillful, a Markle Foundation initiative to create a skills-based labor market that empowers all Americans to succeed in the digital economy. Colbert is leading Skillful's efforts to convene employers, educators, workforce centers, state government, and others to help job seekers and workers keep pace with the transformations automation and technology are bringing to the workforce landscape. She received a bachelor's degree in economics with high honors from Princeton University and an MBA from Stanford University with honors. And she and her husband have two children and currently reside in Denver, Colorado. Fantastic. Okay. And Daniel Werfel leads the public sector practice in North America at the Boston Consulting Group. He joined BCG in 2014 and focuses on all aspects of organizational change, including human capital, risk management, IT modernization, and business process improvement. And he's going to moderate this panel. So I'll turn it over to you. Thank you all so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Anne. Having spent many hours in the Elmer Statz Conference Room, I feel really good to be a part of the Elmer Statz lecture now, more connection to him. So the topic that we're going to talk about today, the future of work, we're actually going to broaden the aperture here, and not just focus on the future of work within the government, but talk about the future of work more broadly. And then through that discussion, maybe think about different themes that we see in the broader discussion and how that might impact how we think about the future of the government workforce. One thought to mention before we kind of get into the topic, which helped me kind of understand the implication. There's a book out there that I read recently called The Second Machine Age. The concept of the book is that we're in a second industrial revolution with respect to the exponential growth of technology. And so the first part of the book is really cool because it just envisions how our world is going to change over the next 10 to 20 years in terms of these technologies and how they're going to, it predicts how it's going to change our lives. So that's neat to read. But what the second part of the book does is it talks about the implication that has on the workforce and on jobs and rolls through a variety of different realities that are happening right now that we might not actually think about every day, but are changing the landscape of our economy, how we should be thinking about our youth and when they're coming out of school and the jobs they have. So an example that just hit me as I was reading the book was the impact that ATMs have had on the career of being a bank teller. And so, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you know, we had many, many, many more bank tellers, and that was a middle class, middle income earning job that sustained a lot of families and made sense for a lot of people coming out of high school or college. And with technology, that whole environment is changed. Even more closer to my own heart, tax preparation, Quicken and all these TurboTax have also had this dramatic impact on that. And you can go on. So it's not just that this is coming. It's happening and happening in real terms. And I think there's fundamental questions about whether we as a economy, as a country, as a society, and as the government, have we really focused on it? I was talking beforehand. It's like, it feels like a tsunami coming, almost like when you talk about climate change. Like there's this real important thing that's coming down the pike that if we're not prepared for is going to fundamentally change our life and reduce the quality of our life. We need to be prepared for this. And are we asking the right questions? Are we asking the right questions of our government leaders? And that's some of the things that we'll explore today. Let me start the question with you, Beth. First of all, the book that I mentioned paints more of a bleaker picture. And basically, it's a call to action. But is that right? Should we be optimistic about the jobs that are coming down the pike that technology is going to create, or pessimistic?
So for those of you who know me, you'd probably say that in general, I am an optimist about all things. I am an optimist on this as well, but not a naive optimist. Change is coming. Change has come to every one of our jobs already. And I think the question is both, what's the nature of the change and how do we respond? When we've seen these economic transformation, whether it's the second industrial age or the fourth industrial revolution, right, you could have looked at that and said, wait, all of the American labor force was employed in agriculture. Those jobs went away, but people moved to new jobs. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we would argue and what we see in our work is we do think there will be net new jobs, jobs we don't know about. All of the jobs that most people who work with Jen in Code for America are jobs that didn't exist, whether you're user experience designers, the people who are monitoring, you know, systems for cybersecurity, many of those jobs are new jobs that didn't exist. And there's some terrific research from the McKinsey Global Institute that it sort of breaks this down and talks about that transformation. There's also some really good BCG research that talks about how, now it's a relevant one, about how, to me, so I'm optimistic that there will be jobs. I think the challenge is, will we act to help people make the transformation to the jobs that are coming? And kind of like climate change, if you think it's coming, you can choose to act about it, and you will end up with a much better set of outcomes in terms of individuals, in terms of equity, in terms of access to opportunity, but you actually have to take action. And so in one of the interesting BCG papers, they actually talk about if you are a bank teller, right, you're not going to be doing bank teller transactions anymore, but what can you do? Right, you have built a set of skills in customer service. Where are the places where those skills are relevant? Could you take that to a healthcare career? Alternatively, you've also built a set of numeracy skills and attention to detail and management skills. You could use that in a quality control role. So it is about helping people understand what are the skills they have and where can those skills go, and particularly for the 70% of the workforce that does not have a bachelor's degree. Unless we act to help people understand those opportunities, get access to the additional training and education they need as individuals, as governments, as companies, it won't be a good transformation. But I think there is an outcome that could be optimistic that will involve growth and changes in productivity.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting because there's a slide on up there we might want to refer to. There's a lot of different stakeholders that we need to engage and activate them around this thinking. And so should we talk a little bit about that stakeholder landscape to make sure that it's guiding the rest of our discussion?
So,
Can I jump in on one thing before we move to that? I mean, the bank teller one is really interesting, and I'm forgetting where I've read the stat, but what Beth said is very true. They're going to go away in some places, but they're going to come back in others. And I think that in fact there are more jobs in retail banking since we have lost ATMs than before.
Yeah.
They are slightly different, but they're not wildly different. And it's really about growing what's possible for us to do as businesses and as a society with technology, not just sort of seeing. There is certainly an enormous threat, I think, with those jobs changing. But that's a place where, in fact, if you're looking just at opportunity for employment, in fact, it's quite a rosy picture. That's been the last 30 years, though. We have to look at what's going to happen in the next 30 years.
Yeah. And it raises, a question in terms of, or just a dynamic. Are we going to kind of let the situation just evolve and see where it takes us versus being more tactical and asking, for example, government leaders and policymakers to create, whether they're legislative frameworks or otherwise, to try to guide us through that transition. I think one of the things about technology, I'm not going to get into it, this whole concept of Moore's Law and how exponential technology is that it seems to happen more quickly. So the industrial age and the way we adjusted and jobs reshaped themselves, 100 years ago is different now, even 30 years ago. So the change from no ATM machine to an ATM machine, that's going to change even quicker as we're going forward.
I think that you're getting very quickly, I think, to the heart of the matter. I think, can we adapt? We've adapted every time. We've been through these shifts before. I think the question is, can we adapt quickly enough this time? It's happening so much faster. We are not built, and I think that's sort of what we want to talk about a little bit on the implementation side of things. We're not built to read data signals very quickly, change policy and implementation very quickly to adapt to different conditions, different uptake, and learn what works, and we have to rebuild government to do that at an order of magnitude greater speed.
Yeah, and one other tension, I think, here, I mean, both are important, but Beth, you touched on reskilling, and retraining, but I also think there's what are we doing in our elementary and secondary education, in our job training programs, in our colleges and universities around ensuring that they have line of sight, and how do those curricula and programs change? And again, there's a world in which we are free market and it just happens, or are we at a point at which, with the way technology is changing and the concerns that we have, that things have to happen differently this time, and we need to have a different type of call to action that touches not just current reskilling but the future pipeline of workers and changing the way they're prepared to enter the workforce?
No, I think that's all. I would go all of the above here. One, because the near-term challenge, when we spend a lot of time at Skillful working with employers, and we're working with employers because we know that the path to connect people to opportunity is through a job, right? So as the colleagues I see in the room who've spent more time in workforce than I have, will tell you, right, training programs that don't actually lead to people having the skills that are in demand by employers and don't connect them to them. We have a long history of ones that have been created with great intent, and when you look at their efficacy is really low. So unless you start from, unless you start with the demand end, what are employers looking for, what do they need, how do they think about this, we will not help people make this transition. So you've got to do that, and you have to help those signals, as Jen said, get back not just to, they need to get back to educational institutions of all types. They need to get to individuals. They need to actually get from the front hiring manager to the HR department in a common frame that people can understand, a way of communicating those that is more clear. And you need, you see lots of pilots and experiments of things these days of people starting to respond, but it's the pace that's the challenge, right? There's we did some work in Colorado. Skillful's been operational in Colorado for about 2 years now, and so one of the things we did is work with a set that was trying to develop what's a skills-based description of what you need to be sort of an entry-level network administrator. It's a good job. It pays a good wage. There's high demand, and there's not enough of them. It's also a place that from a sort of current perspective, is very over-degreed. Something like 75% of postings for entry-level network administrators require a bachelor's degree, and less than 30% of the people in those roles have a bachelor's degree. So that is a place where someone could actually get access to a good job even if they don't yet have a college degree, but there's something getting in the way. We worked with a set of employers to articulate what are those skills, how do you communicate them. That was all great. There was a very enterprising community college professor at Aurora Community College, so just east of Denver on your way to the airport. You've probably driven by that. Who looked at that and said, gee, I can change my class. I'm teaching two-thirds or more of what these employers are asking for, but one, I'm not describing it in terms employers understand. And two, the other third, that fits. I'll just change what I'm doing. She took the initiative. She rebuilt the course. She got it accredited. She did that in 9 months. Now, that was an enterprising individual. The question is, how do we get the system to move at the pace she was moving?
Yeah, and one thing I just want to reflect on as we think about these questions is I think I framed it as something's coming down the pike and how do we plan for the future. But the reality is I think you can look at the world today, whether you want to look at it through the lens of income gap or not unemployment necessarily the way we technically measure it, but poverty. And other things that are going on in the United States today, which is a story, but how do you look at it through the lens of do we already see the manifestation of this problem, and are we already behind on it?
Well, I would add to the discussion of what it takes to get a job, which we see this in our work too, exactly the same stuff. There's just sort of this mismatch between the skills people actually have in many cases and the ability to map them to the job, it is not just jobs. It is also the gig economy. I'll put a little plug in for another book. Second Change is a great one. Conflict happens to be my husband's book. It's called What's the Future and Why It's Up to Us.
It's a good book. I've actually read it. An independent endorsement.
Thank you. Excellent. That's all I'm going to do today. The acronym is What's the Future, but the acronym is WTF. We like to be edgy in California. The author, who does happen to be my husband, says, it's work, not jobs. And increasingly, we have to accept that while we think of the only way to have somebody get a middle class lifestyle is through a job, that isn't, that's not necessarily going to be available. Yeah. And we need to create economic policy, safety net policy, to account for the fact that people will be doing various types of work. Now, there's a couple advantages of that. One is that an enormous amount more flexibility for the workers many times. Certainly also, though, that mapping of skills to... there is not as many barriers between matching people in the gig economy. There's less reliance on these sort of false identifiers like a bachelor's degree that doesn't actually tell you whether that person is going to be good at this or not. And the other thing is, you see a lot in the gig economy a little bit of a different version of the robots are going to come take my job, which is I can do the job because I'm half a robot. So taking a Lyft or an Uber anywhere, that person does not know what a taxi driver used to know. You used to have to know where to go. I don't think many of my Uber drivers or Lyft drivers have any idea. They're just following what the computer is telling them to do, and they don't think of it as a computer, but that's what it is. And they're doing a job, and they're doing it relatively well. You may have different views. I think the cars are more comfortable often.
But I think that I like the Uber example a lot.
They're augmented.
Let me ask a different, I've thought about this in terms of, the technology of driverless cars, mm-hmm. right? And there's a future, potentially, I don't know how many years from now, maybe 5, maybe 10, where Uber does not have to pay drivers anymore because the entire network is driverless cars,
and
right?
We think that's further off than people have been saying.
Okay.
But I don't think that necessarily means that we're not going to be dealing with that kind of disruption.
But it raises a question for me in terms of should we just allow that to happen? Like, is there a point at which you intervene and say that through, and I'm not opining an answer on this because I know it's a controversial question, but do you create an environment and regulate an environment in a way that preserves these jobs and curbs the technology, or do you just let the technology go and we deal with it at the back end?
I have a brief view on that. If you
go ahead, you go first. I'll go after.
I think we absolutely have to intervene. The question is, where do you intervene? And I think if you ask yourself, is all the work that needs to be done in our society being done right now? The answer is no. So why not put people on higher value things? But if we just don't intervene and say, we're just going to let this, you know, let the chips fall where they may, we don't have a safety net for these people. We're going to have a revolution in this country. But do you intervene and say, no, we're not going to allow this technology to disrupt this particular job? I think there's other ways to intervene that say, what does the society look like that we want? How are we going to smartly adopt these technological innovations, redeploy people to the things that absolutely need to be done? We have an aging population. There is an enormous amount of need to help old people, for instance. That's another thing that's really well done, augmented with technology. But let's just put people in jobs that create greater and greater value.
I'm going to raise an interesting point about government and policymakers intervening. I would say that they often do, but not in things that should maybe be let go forward, but they do because it's happening in their backyard, right? So if there's a good answer technology-wise or business-wise, or even if the government, for example, wants to shut down a government building, and that could mean that jobs are going to be lost, you know, those congressional delegations will come in and protect those jobs at the microcosm.
That is a bipartisan solution to closing.
Right. But my point is, I mean, this is just my reflection that I've seen Congress act many, 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 many times over, that to prevent what otherwise would have been a good business outcome or the right business outcome because of the job impact it has in their local market. But if technology is going to, let's say, cut the number of truck drivers or Uber drivers by 20% across the whole U.S., that then if you regulate that, then it feels much more like big government regulating industry in a way that's likely to get bipartisan outrage. So just a thought in terms of how we think about curbing jobs.
Although, Dan, as you describe that, right, so I will say that, you know, the force, because the economic benefits and the benefits of some of these things can be very real, right? And they're powerful and they are hard to avoid. And so to me, the question is less, do we prevent self-driving cars? There's going to be huge value from self-driving cars, whether it's actually getting bad drivers. I know there's issues with self-driving cars. They need regulation. But, like, there's a lot of bad human drivers on the road.
I'm one of them.
There's a lot of folks, as people get older, you know, enormous challenges in their life because they don't have the ability to get to where they need to go. So the question is not just do we do that, but how do we actually help the people who are going to be displaced to make the transitions in more effective ways that programs we've tried to do that with in the past work, right? So some of that says, you know, in the way much of that assistance happens today, you have to wait until you've lost your job before you get access to any benefit to make a transition, right? Why is that the model so that you're already sort of down the pike? Because you know it's coming, right? We know it's coming. How do we think about those things? We see it in companies, right, who are making those, who are thinking about this. But, like, so when do you do that? How do you change the mindset that sort of says in this society, you know, success is you went to college from 18 to 22, and any other pathway that you take around how you get educated, what that education means, is not as good as if you did it from 18 to 22. And by the way, those skills are getting stale. So if you were a computer science major when I went to college, there's pretty little of what you might have learned that is relevant to a modern IT system. So my degree isn't even relevant. So how do you think about giving people the information to make better choices. Do I enroll in that commercial driver's license program? What are the earnings? How long are they going to last for? How does the government, you know, provide those incentives? How do you let people adapt before? And I think, from, again, when we work with employers, they're thinking about, okay, I have folks in my workforce who have a certain set of skills. How do I get them the skills I need for the future? Because nobody has those. Like, there are not enough people in America who have cybersecurity skills. Many people here can attest to that. There are not enough people who have some of the data analytics skills. And so if you're a truck driver, what are the skills you actually have? How do you use those? And how do you have a mindset that I'm not just a truck driver, I'm actually a person who, you know, has time management skills and independent this, and, you know, where do you go next? So I don't think it's stopping it. It's having a better response.
Yeah, and a question I'll ask to both of you is, are we focusing maybe too much on the high skill end, right? In this, you know, because, you know, there was a time that I can remember where it was all the rage to go to law school, and everyone was going to law school, and then all of a sudden the numbers started to drop because the you know, it just the
technology is taking those jobs.
Right. But these are, you know, if you're looking at that level of education, the economy, and like seeing how advanced degrees are reshaping themselves in terms of supply, demand, and the numbers of people, that's important and it's interesting. But there's also, as we were talking about, a whole other and probably much larger block of individuals currently in the workforce or coming up through the workforce who are not going to be on an advanced degree path and are not going to pivot between being a lawyer and a doctor into some kind of data scientist or something. There are a ton of people that are going to do that. But for those, I think that's another key question that we have to ask about, are we prepared for the diverse set of individuals that are coming through and where they're going to land on that spectrum?
So one of the ways we need to think about that problem, you know, at first I layer in, again, these augmented jobs. So if you have a job where you're essentially doing what a computer tells you to do, what is your, you know, what's your value add? How can you succeed? And where are you likely to fail, right? Well, your value add increasingly is going to be soft skills. Mm-hmm. So, again, think about home health care. Huge, huge need. Increasingly, we can give people the information they need at the moment that they need it because they're in a contextual environment. They have a piece of software. In fact, our former colleague, Todd Park, has a startup that's going to be doing this to really democratize health care. And I think increasingly you don't need people to do an enormous amount of training if you can augment them with the information they need at the time that they need it. But I think, and I think that you see this in your work too, you get people who are failing in lower skilled jobs or augment skilled jobs, in fact, because they are not set up to succeed in the rest of their lives. And that's why I don't think the discussion about the future of work can ignore things like social safety net, economic policy, child care policy. You know, you have people who, you know, at that point you really just need to have good soft skills and show up to work. But there's all these reasons why people just don't even get to show up for work on time, and it's a very multi-level problem that I think has to do with a lot of things that are going on in our society, where you have people trying to succeed in jobs who the deck is so stacked against them.
Yeah, and it feels like we're in the middle of a major transition. Let me just tell folks in the audience that there are microphones set up for you to be participatory in this, and with both questions and insights. I was reflecting earlier, there's a lot of smart people in the room who have been thinking about these issues and would love to get your participation and input into the discussion. So should we spend a little bit of time on the stakeholders,
sure,
just to
sure.
kind of, because if we're going to be activating or thinking about activating different parts of our economy and the labor market to react, it'd be good to know who are we activating.
So let me start, and again, I would expect some either now or later, expert commentary from those of you in the room. But when I started at Skillful, I started with these. So who's out there? And if we're going to move to a skills-based labor market, and in that we mean a place where employers think about what is it I actually need in terms of skills and capabilities? How do I know someone has that at a much finer degree of granularity, but at a practical way so that, you know, my husband runs a 100-person manufacturing company in Colorado. So they are the persona of the employer I'm thinking about, right? Because most of America is small businesses. They don't have big HR departments. They don't have big training departments. They're trying to figure out who they're going to get to come work. And, in fact, in this case, it's a pretty manual place, but every machine they have has some computer-controlled device on it that is keeping track of data and giving results. That's a fair description of where most of the world is today. So how do you connect them to job seekers who don't actually understand what skills they had? And again, remember, we are focused on the 70% of the workforce that does not have a bachelor's degree, right? As someone who, like Danny, did the analytical perspectives part of the budget book every year, where you have that chart in the back that shows the educational levels of the federal workforce versus the private sector. The federal workforce is vastly more educated on average than the private sector. So just to put that in context. So there's a whole set of people showed in this sort of nicely organized looking slide here, which includes employers. There's job seekers, a lot of work for career people who advise them, which we've called coaches, and educators, and a whole series of things that influence that, which include data and funding flows. So there's a lot of interaction with the government here and government as you bring these things together. And you can think about, if I do this right, in each one of those, you can go layers and layers deep around the kinds of institutions that are there, the kinds of associations. So to make change happen, to have a different way for people to think about what do they bring to work, how do they bring that to an employer when they're looking for a job or looking for a promotion or a job that's going to last in the 21st century, there's a lot of places to orchestrate to make change happen, and it has implications for policy. It has a lot of implications for how policy is executed. It has a lot of implications for what these actors do as they make their own decisions. So that's the world you're trying to orchestrate, at least we think, to say, how do you make this work in a 21st century world where demand signals and the potential of technology and digitization are changing the underlying requirements really fast? So if that's what it looks like from a policy lens, I'm going to turn it over to Jen, who will tell you what it looks like from the lens of people in the world.
Yeah, so this is relatively neat, mostly because you made wonderful slides.
It's all those years of training.
So at Code for America, we sort of our religion is sort of user experience. What is the person who's actually in the system actually going through? What does it look like from their perspective? And we have something called journey maps. I didn't put our journey maps in there, but our team likes to say, you know, people say, tell me about the workforce system. They say, it's not a system. It doesn't actually meet the definition of a system, which would be something that would have a feedback loop in it such that when something happens, you can it's a build, measure, learn cycle. You can figure out whether it worked and then take that feedback back and then improve the system. That's what systems should do, and this one doesn't. It's incredibly complex, and if that looks like an ugly, messy slide, that's intentional because that's sort of what it feels like when you're trying to navigate it. And I think it also gets to the frustration of many people who, like in Beth's position, who are, there's so many pieces to push on and try to sort of pull together. But I think the opportunity there is if we recognize that and we say, fundamentally, this is a bunch of pieces that are trying to act in some degree of coordination but aren't actually adding up to a system that, for instance, could read those demand signals very quickly and react. What would you do to make it, to make it look like this? And I think I'm going to skip over these pretty quickly. We can go back to them. But we have a sort of a very challenging, possibly provocative view of what you need to do. And it's not just sort of looking at it from the user view, which I said is sort of our religion, understand and meet the needs of users. But right now, when you're trying to understand what's working in, say, workforce retraining, most of the time, when you think about data, I assume, please nod or shake your head to tell me if you agree with this, you're getting data a couple years later in a binder, right? Well, the systems that work today that are responsive, adaptive, successful, growing, are ones in which data points, the systems themselves are instrumented, by which I mean the data immediately gets back to some place where somebody is acting on it in almost real time. It is, you think about regulation, you know, it is like the way your body regulates very quickly. I'm in a hot room, I start sweating. That's regulation. Our systems in government were not built to be fundamentally instrumented. We didn't think about it when we built our technology systems. We just thought about doing the thing, not actually having the feedback loop. So getting, you know, fundamentally re-architecting our data systems so that they give you near real-time, not just aggregate data, but user data. Like, if you could actually know that people are trying to do this thing and failing, you can actually very quickly start to adapt your policies and your operations. So, and then iterate all the way through. So this is the part you may start to think I'm crazy by showing you, because I came out of the technology world. I didn't know old process, but this is what it sort of looks like. Policy. You start with a policy. You build a process, a system to support that process. At some point, you go see if users like it, but then you end up in sort of a stasis. And what we're saying is to get to this new world where you have instrumented systems and tight feedback loops so that you can actually adapt at the speed that we need to adapt to meet this challenge, you actually have to start with users, take the services that we have, like the workforce quote-unquote system, fundamentally redesign them, then you sort of build the system, and really policy comes in as a result of actually understanding what's going on with your users. And policy becomes much more agile and adaptive, and you have this very tight feedback loop. And this is really hard to go from the old system, the old process, to the new process. And it involves building teams that have skills across a wider variety of disciplines than we have built teams in government before. But I think it's important and difficult work. Do you want to take it back?
So
I don't remember what's the next slide. The first slide?
No, they can't.
Oh, yeah, that's my... Do you want me to keep going on that? Or keep going.
Or you can go to the... this one.
Oh, yeah, so let me... Yeah, we'll just give that example. That's great. So, actually, do you want to set up...
So we've been doing some work in Colorado, right? And one of the pieces to try and make the system better is better information, right? So I am an individual trying to decide whether I should invest in some kind of training that will help me get to a job that's going to be robust in the 21st century. So if I go, and so I'm a person doing this, the odds are I'm going to pick up my phone, not a computer, my phone. I am going to Google... welding jobs in Colorado. Well, it's welding training in Colorado. What shows up on your phone first is whoever's paid for ads for their welding training program, right? That's at the top of the list. And no real data that's particularly reliable of what are the real options for welding training? What does Aurora Community College do versus Emily Griffith Technical College versus a for-profit institution or whatever it may be? Like, I get nothing. And so in us trying to help, as we were trying to do our work, one of sort of the fundamental tenets as we needed these better signals, you want to get data that could help you do that. Some of that data exists in the system. It's just not instrumented. So there are individuals who enrolled. Emily Griffith is actually a really innovative career and technical education provider in the city of Denver. Interestingly, it's the most innovative thing in the city, and it's 100 years old, so it is proof that people can actually stay innovative. How do you know what happened to people who went through their welding program? Well, that data actually exists somewhere in the Colorado State UI system, right? We have people, you can link them together, you can do it in ways that is sufficiently privacy protected and all those good things. But how do you build that? And that's what this is. We have been working with a group called BrightHive, a guy named Matt Gee, who some of the folks here know from the University of Chicago Data Impact Lab, who's doing a lot of this open source, open architecture development. So you can say, you know, how do you get a system where people can answer that question? And as an employee, not just as an individual, as an education institution, I can find out, okay, these people went to my program. Like, what happened to them? Am I actually helping them do what it's my mission to do? And if I'm an employer, I can find out, you know, what happens to those folks? And you could pull that data not just from the UI system, but what do you know from their LinkedIn profile and lots of other sources. So,
yeah, so this is just sort of a front end on that data that we have prototyped at Code for America. We also are working with these guys. So I don't know if you can see it very well, but, you know, it's kind of like a Yelp or something for, you know, if you searched on, you know, wind turbine technician training,
yeah.
You can see, A, that it's a mile and a half from you, that it has a 78% graduation rate, that 56% of the people who graduated are actually employed. By the way, this is fictional. It's just, we don't have the data yet, so we're making it up. It has a rate, I guess it was a user-generated rating of 8.9, but, you know, from users. But right now, those can do, that's what we start to expect, right? So, Tom Loosemore from the Government Digital Service defines digital as simply meeting raised expectations. That's part of what we're trying to do here, but that is the kind of thing that we need to be, this kind of information is what we need to be able to provide folks who have this need if we're going to end up putting the money, the limited amount of money that we have, into the things that actually work. We're going to empower people to make those choices.
Well, what's interesting, and I think there was a question from the audience that we'll go to in a second, is that we started the talk by talking about how technology and its advancement is creating this problem, and now we're full circle to how advancing technology is going to help us solve the problem.
Absolutely.
As well, by connecting information to people on their job journey in ways that we haven't done before.
But, yeah. But I just want to make sure we see it's not technology that will do it. It is actually using the data that will do it. We've got
yeah.
to close the loop.
Yeah.
If we add technology, but we don't actually close the loop, we just spend more money.
Yeah. Did you want to ask a question?
Is it on?
Oh,
yes. It is.
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, I'm Bob Kravchuk. I'm at Indiana University. And I wanted to see if I couldn't tie this a little bit to a discussion we had this morning in the session on AI. Here we were talking about the number of jobs that will be eliminated through the rollout of artificial intelligence, machine learning, and other technologies, as well as the net new jobs that will be produced as a consequence of these new technologies. And I was thinking about this in terms of, you know, the 70% of the workforce that isn't college educated. It just seems to me the direction is very, very clear in terms of technology. This is a freight train and it is moving ahead and nothing can stop it. It's like an unstoppable force.
Right.
This is occurring at a time when it seems that our social system and the educational system are not prepared for it.
Yes.
K through 12, with all due respect to people who might be teachers or have teachers and their families, is failing a generation. It's probably going on a generation and a half of students. I deal with the undergraduates all the time. They want to learn the formula. They don't want to deal with a word problem. They want to apply something. They show you how to do it. They do it, and then they move on. They're not, you know, adapting in the way that we need them to. They're not able to analyze the data. We need to spend time in remediation, clearly. At the college level, I deal with a lot of neighbors out in the county outside of Bloomington where I reside who are blue-collar people. If you want to know the kind of person I'm talking about, if you've read J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy, mm-hmm. That's them. They don't want to move to learn a new job. They don't want to go through job training. They want a job in a factory like they used to have. There's a mindset here. There's a culture. There's something that is missing. And if you've read the book, what saved J.D. himself was 4 years in the Marine Corps, where he learned personal responsibility. So that's what got him out of the cycle. And so I'm just thinking that things are moving in a direction, not to mention the political winds that have blown, the mobilization of people who are economically threatened and disaffected. We have a problem. You guys could have the best technology in the world, but matching that up with the people that actually need it is going to take another kind of a leap. That was just my comment.
So, if I can respond.
Please.
One, it's great to have someone from Indiana here. We have actually just, we are going to be launching an effort in Indiana with the governor and the team there. So I've actually been driving around Indiana. I was in Bloomington last week, so.
You got running water, indoor plumbing.
It's great. I have been there all year long, and I agree with you. It's terrific. I think, though, what this comes back to, your mindset piece is absolutely fundamental. But I do think also This and it's a big change, right? This is a big mindset change, a values change. What the messaging we have told people is one, you know, you individually have failed because you didn't put yourself in a place to respond, right? So the whole messaging has to start again that says, you know, that. And two, there's also a bit of a theme of the things you've learned and done in your manufacturing job that may be going away, or even more rapidly, your frontline basic skills retail job that's going away. That stuff is irrelevant to your future. And I think that those are both wrong premises. And so to me, the way you can get from here to there is to actually figure out what is it that people have learned, because they bring a lot of skills in those jobs, and how do you make that transition? And you don't sort of start that, in my mind, after you've kicked them out of their job, they've been unemployed for a while, and now you want them to go do something. So, like, you know, take an AT&T, right? AT&T is investing $1 billion to reskill their workforce. Stanley Black & Decker, so, you know, Stanley Tools Black & Decker, has a whole program that they have put in place to retrain their factory workforce to move, because they have a set of people who they can't get enough talent up out of K-12. They have folks in their workforce who they think can change, and maybe not all of them, but done it with a different kind of framing, they've seen people pick up on those opportunities because they're also delivering them in a way that people can get them, right? If you're working a job that maybe your pays an eh kind of wage, you probably have a second job. You're driving Uber and Lyft on the side, right? I do spend my days talking to all my Uber and Lyft drivers. They are part of my market research. And so then saying to that person, so between your job, the care you're doing for your elderly parent that you're not getting any help with, et cetera, we now want you to go do something else on top of that, right? There's just no hours in the day. So I think there is a different framing if we're going to do that, because otherwise we will lose that talent. And we can't lose all that talent. That is a skilled workforce. It's just we have to think about how we can meet them where they are to get those skills to change. And it's a whole bit about how it's messaged, what you do, how you structure that. And technology can help, but it's not technology alone that's going to get us from here to there. So it's basically me agreeing with you.
Well, it seems like there's three different types of or cohorts of people that we've been talking about. There are those that are in the workforce today, where they're there and there's an opportunity to reskill them. There's kind of privity between the employer and the employee right now, and maybe a better chance of getting them in the right mindset for change. There's the students, youth that are coming up, and making sure that we're supporting curricula and activities that are going to best position them. But the third, I think, which is really challenging, is those that are already out of work, that are disconnected from employment, and therefore it feels like climbing Mount Everest to get to a point where you're suddenly going to go to school, get training, and so all of these things seem really challenging. And one of the questions that I would raise is, are we addressing this smartly as policymakers in government right now? I mean, you could make the case, and we'll set that aside, that the government shouldn't have a role here and we shouldn't be legislating or regulating, and maybe that's the right or the wrong answer. I'm going to set that aside. But right now, if you think about what are the key policy issues that dominate the national consciousness, there are things like health. There are really important issues like healthcare, and immigration, and climate change, to name three. But I don't get a sense, and others in the room can disagree, that the issue that we're talking about holds a place in our national dialogue in a cohesive way around what we need to be doing and what the policy should be. And maybe we're just not set up, or this issue is not set up for that type of dialogue, and it's not something the government can really do. But do you want to comment on that? Is there something the government should be thinking differently to elevate this issue, or is it something that as of a different flavor than healthcare or immigration or climate change, and really requires more of a bottoms-up organic solution that's going to come out over time.
Governors and mayors care a lot about this.
That's
it's like the first thing out of their mouth.
Yeah, so, I mean, I actually would agree with Jen. I think this is an issue that actually, in contrast to some of those, still is a place where you get a lot of bipartisan relative consensus, right? You know, whether it's John Hickenlooper and John Kasich in their dynamic duo, you know, we're working with John Hickenlooper and Eric Holcomb, right? One's a Democrat, one's a Republican. The skillful, we've created sort of a bit of a learning collaborative around this topic of workforce transformation. There are 20 states in the Skillful State Network, 12 Republican, 8 Democrat. So I actually think this is a place where at the state level there is a lot of thinking being done on this. We did a Wordle analysis of governor's state of the state speeches. They talk about this a lot. Mayors talk about this a lot. And they talk about a range of things that encompass sort of more work-based learning in the school system, whether that's apprenticeships or externships. They talk about trying to find more flexibility in how you can fund investments in ongoing education, so more flexible Pell kinds of as one mechanism for doing that. In some cases, you've got incentives to have employers invest more in training. There's an initiative in Indiana called Next Level Jobs, where as an employer, you can get a grant to retrain your employees if you're a small business. So I think there's actually a place sort of that lives below, and some of it shows up, like some of it was part of the WIOA reauthorization, was to get more focus on outcomes. So I think it's there, and it is at the moment one of the places where you can still get people who have different color T-shirts having a shared conversation.
The sort of the counter, I think, to the J.D. Vance, the Hillbilly Elegy, is what is Jim and Deb Fallow's new book called?
Our Town. Is that what it is? No. Jim and Deb Fallow's book about towns that are working, right?
Yeah.
Small cities that are working.
So you actually have that, and then you're increasingly seeing sort of a national network of these, you know, bottom-up solutions, you know, coming together, and I think while it's also, so my first reaction is, you know, it is the first thing out of their mouths from mayors and governors to us, right? Like, it's actually the last thing in our maturity pipeline. We do a lot more in social safety net. This is earlier work for us, but that's the thing they most want us to do. But they also, I mean, they're sort of followed with, I don't know if you would agree with this, but like, it's their top priority, but they don't quite know what to do.
Yeah.
And I think what you're going to see, much like what Jim and Deb are sort of showing, is, you know, while many of these policies, you know, arguably will only work at the national level, and people know that, and it's sort of, you know, maybe in some places a non-starter, you do see a lot of local experimentation. So trying this is not on workforce, but more on safety, but, you know, the universal basic income pilots in various places. There are a number of proposals to, you know, go right at this, you know, robots are going to take our jobs thing and say, okay, let's take two problems and make them a solution. We have robots that can do things and displace humans, and then we have humans that are already doing work that is not recognized as work, like childcare and senior care. Tax the robots and pay the people who are doing the work as just an infusion into the economy. And I think that will be a bold move, I think, you know, just for someone to do that locally. But I think you are going to see these experiments, and then I think, you know, it will, if some of them work, hopefully
they will
speak for themselves.
I think it's... please, Jeff.
I had a question for you. You mentioned the educational system. When I went to school, you had a lot of vocational education. Yep. And kids were slotted into whether they went to college or not. Then we had this, everybody needs to go to college. Do you see a shift? I saw one state recently, so they're going to allocate a lot of their money to vocational education. But teaching, starting in the 8th or 9th grade, saying this person is going to go to college, this person is going to do something else. Do you see that as being?
So I will, from my perspective, and I am not an education policy expert, but I think there is something that is quite different from that. What we hear about is lots of focus on career exploration through K-12, but I think it's really important that this trap of you're either going to college or you're going to a vocational school will fall apart because for the same reasons it kind of fell apart before. You are telling a set of people that they're not good. In today's society, when you say you're not going to college, that is the implicit message. And I think there is a very different message around everybody's going to need additional learning over the course of their lifetime. It's just how do you get it in different kinds of structures and different kinds of ways, and you can do it. The apprenticeship program in Colorado, as I live there these days, right, is designed after the Swiss model, and in Switzerland, right, and in Colorado, it includes everything from more traditional kind of apprenticeship things to working at insurance companies at like basic actuary level skills where you would ultimately go to college. So I think we need to escape this either or, because I don't think that actually paints the picture of what people will need over the course of their lifetime.
I didn't phrase that well enough. It's to say there's as much value in doing these other things because we value those, and
yep.
those jobs are very important. And even today, finding a plumber that will show up or any of those jobs, they're well-paying jobs, and they don't have enough people to fill many of those jobs.
Yep. And like basic accounting jobs, if you look at this analysis in the McKinsey Global Institute, like a basic accounting job, that job is actually going away a lot faster than the plumbing job.
I agree with
that. Please, can you use the mic? Thank you.
And that plumbing job may be an entrepreneur.
One, I just wanted to, I'm Jack Knott from the Price School of Public Policy at USC. I think you made a really good suggestion about capital. I want to recommend a book, Beyond the Second Machine Age.
Okay, cool.
And it's called The Platform Revolution. It's by Jeff Parker, Marshall Van Alstyne, and Sanjit Chowdhury. I think it's the most powerful book I've read on this topic. And one of the things it talks about is that the relationship between capital and labor is changing. Capital is becoming a bigger part of overall productivity. And this goes to your point about should we be taxing capital? You know, there's a lot of talk about giving a basic income. I don't think that's going to be possible if you're just taxing labor. You're not going to get enough money out of doing that. You're going to have to tax capital if you're going to have basic income or if you're going to even do what you suggest. This book suggests that this relationship between capital and labor is going to flip. Eventually, most of productivity is going to be brought about by capital. The second point is that the platform revolution is creating, they argue, a lot of inequality and jobs that aren't very good. And Uber is a good example of that. These people have jobs, but they don't get paid very much. They don't have any benefits, et cetera. They're contract employees. And you can think of, you think about it's just Uber, but think of the Washington Post. The Washington Post today is a platform, and so is the New York Times. 10 times as many people get the Washington Post online as get it in paper. And the Washington Post is way bigger than it was 5 years ago, but it has 300 fewer employees. And the kind of employees it's been hiring are Uber-type employees, contract employees all around the world. And so my question is about whether you've thought about this platform revolution, which is disrupting almost every industry, and not just, you know, technology working with workers and things like this. What kind of jobs are platforms creating? Are they the kind of jobs that are going to sustain families and pay a decent wage?
I think you'll like the WTF book too. It's very much along the same lines. I would not argue that the platforms are creating jobs that are not great. What I would argue is we're not going to stop them. We cannot regulate them out of existence. What we can do is intervene smartly. And I think we have to completely reinvent a safety net for the 21st century, given that that is what's happening. And we have to reinvent, and we have to create economic policy that deals with that as a reality, would be my view.
There's one.
I just want to give you one fact. For example, Instagram sold after about 4 years. Instagram.
Microphone.
It's just a quick fact.
They can't hear it. They want to hear your fact.
Instagram sold after about 4 years for $4 billion.
Yep.
It had 15 employees.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. And so these, and you can multiply those examples. These platforms are creating incredible inequalities in wealth, and I'm not against platforms. I mean, that's going to be the future, right?
Oh, that's but, okay. You can be against platforms.
But no, it's okay.
it's just a dimension of what you've been talking about that I think needs to be
helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, Myrtle Gautam, University of Nevada, Reno. We have some really living examples right now of what's going on in communities and states, nothing driven by the federal government or anything at the national level. You look at Foxconn moving into Milwaukee, 10,000 people. You look at Panasonic, Tesla moving into northern Nevada and all the other major manufacturers moving there. We had an issue with 6,500 people required by one plant. There was a movement. There was a coming together of the Governor's Office of Economic Development. There was the Economic Development of Western Nevada. There's a university. There's the technical college, the community college, building pathways for students from high school to the community college, possibly to the university. The university is starting certificate programs, working with the industry. The result is that we have people right now moving into new jobs, what we're talking about, jobs of the future. Half the things are done robotically. It's a robot-human interaction. You train the people an apprenticeship for 3 weeks, get them working on a machine, at the same time make sure they're getting a two-year degree, which takes them through, which will walk them through the minefield of the coming 40 years of their life. The governor's office has now provided funding and programs to help those who have been rehabilitated through the justice system, now provide them with skills, life skills, career skills, so they can get jobs in these new, in this new space with robots all around them. So there are some living examples right now in northern Nevada. Yeah. There are examples which are coming up in Wisconsin with Foxconn. There are examples, and this will be a statewide thing, and community thing at the local level. We just have to figure that out. And with all the HQ2s coming around now, with 10,000 jobs, and I'll just take an example. Bethesda is being talked about. You don't have the kind of job. People in Bethesda, they got PhDs. They're not going to work in those positions. Perhaps they will. So it's all local.
So I think this goes to Jen's point from earlier, right, that there are some fantastic experiments going on at the state level, at the city level, of people responding to real problems. And I think one of the things we try to do in our work through our state network is to say, what are those things? What is working? And how then do you take the lessons from that and replicate it? And how then do you use that to sort of shape policy to say we can do more of that kind of response versus, you know, the alternative is like everybody ends, right? The people don't get connected to the jobs. The employers don't get the talent they need to grow, right? The education institutions are not providing, you know, they will suffer because ultimately people will be able to figure out that they're not learning what they need to learn. But there are real examples, and that's a great one on the ground. And there's many others, by the way, of creative on-the-ground solutions of that spaghetti thing that Jen showed the picture of actually coming together in a way that works.
Yeah, it feels like the maturity of these solutions, you know, in terms of the thought process, is still at the lower end. And what I mean by that is, you know, earlier, Jen, I thought it was a critical comment you made where you said the governors and mayors, it's the first thing they're talking about, but they're not necessarily, they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
We have these very encouraging examples that were brought out in Nevada and Wisconsin. And we have some thoughtful people writing books that are raising issues like taxing capital versus labor. But again, my question that I started with is it has it elevated enough And maybe it has at the state and local level, but are we at the maturity curve where we're orienting towards real solutions at the right pace?
You're never doing anything at the right pace, right? These problems, because technology moves so fast and the challenge moves so fast. So there is, you know, again, besides being an optimist, I'm also impatient. So we're never moving at the right pace. But I do think, again, in the conversations we have, and it has been much more state and local focused, the degree of energy being devoted to what is that example, how do I replicate it, how do I take my Aurora Community College person and make that work at that one campus and then at the 20 campuses of the Colorado Community College System, those conversations, I feel like they are happening. Now, how do you get the resources to do that? How do you fund that? The workforce system, which is where some of this happens, as you know, their funding keeps going down because unemployment's going down. So there's a massive amount of executional challenge, but I think there is a lot of attention.
Yeah, I also think the learning needs to be global. In other words, we should be tracking how other countries or other localities are tackling and solving and framing this issue as well, so that there's awareness.
Singapore and Switzerland.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out how to word this, but I think what I would observe is that this conversation about the future of work is the first thing that everyone in Silicon Valley is talking about. And I absolutely want to recognize that you know, you have very wealthy, you know, an enormous amount of wealth that's been created. The Instagram example is well taken, but there's a lot others like that. And a lot of these people happen to be friends and funders of Code for America. I have my critiques of us, you know, running our country through that kind of wealth. But I would say that the community out in Silicon Valley thinks about this and talks about this all the time. So, you know, I mentioned a universal basic income experiment. I think there's a couple, but the one I know best is run by one of those guys who made an enormous fortune from that Instagram sale. I think Instagram is one of the portfolio. A guy named Sam Altman. He's like personally funding a universal basic income experiment. So, you know, this is one of the themes that I always come back to, which is, can this community talk a lot more with the folks in Silicon Valley who want to be bold in their experiments and what to do? And they don't necessarily have the same understanding of how government works that the incredible brain trust in this room does, but they are interested in helping solve. I think some of them are very interested in helping solve the problems that they know they created, and they think that some of the skills and approaches that they had, that they used to build these businesses that created such wealth, might be relevant to the problem. I want them to come to the table with enormous humility, and that doesn't always happen. But I do think that, you know, part of the solution is going to be you know, the incredible skills and experience in this room, finding a way to have a conversation with a group of people who think kind of differently. And we've got to translate between these two communities.
Great. I think one more question from the audience, or... Oh, good. Great.
Hi. Thank you for a great panel. I understand that in the president's reorganization plan, there is language that encourages or would require the Department of Labor to orient itself around workplace development, workplace transformation. What kind of recommendations would you make, given your experiences at the federal level as well as state, local, and other sectors, for what the Department of Labor might do?
It's a good question. I will admit that having moved to Denver, I am not spending as much time reading about the reorganization's plans and the president's management agenda. I know there are other people here who are. I think there's a couple things. And some of it builds on, you know, these are more principles than they relate to reorganization. And actually, some of it builds on the work that was done in WIOA, right? How do you use data that enables you to think about not just running programs, but running programs that deliver results for the people that you're trying to help. That's one piece, and have that be there. I think there's a bit about, again, from my experience working in the field, is how do you get the right degree of flexibility on the ground? What you hear from folks on the ground is, I've got this program that lets me do this so I can help a half of a person this way and this way. And so how do you get that right balance of local flexibility to do these more agile experiments, yet still, you know, have the quality control to make sure that we are spending taxpayer dollars wisely? And there's probably, just broadly from a policy perspective, a little more room for recognizing that we can get more rapid data and feedback on programs than perhaps we once could, and so maybe that would allow us to have some more policy flexibility around programs that work. I think there's questions about how do you ensure a role that says these programs, whether they're training programs in this way, you know, that are actually doing a good job for people, right? So if we're going to spend federal dollars, or people going to spend their personal dollars and invest in something, that there's some degree of quality associated with it. I think those are important pieces. And so I think it's those kinds of principles that would say, how do we do that? And how do we create, which I know people here spend a lot of time on, the right level of, you know, federal standards yet local flexibility? Because what you need in Reno and what you need in Bloomington and what you need in Colorado Springs and, you know, pick your next, you know, Trenton, New Jersey, are different, right? The environment is different, the need is different, and so how do you ensure some level of quality and oversight without overburdening that? So those are some of the principles about data and flexibility and fast feedback loops that I would embed, and I will leave the rest of the organization question to others.
So since we're out of time, I'll take the last word on this question too, as the moderator's prerogative.
That's good.
But you know, I'm looking around the room, I see people that I've worked with on this before in past lives. But there's historically been a reflection that our labor, education, job training programs are fragmented across the government, and that there is an opportunity to rationalize. There's a lot of diversity of job training programs that we have out there, and it's been difficult for any administration, because of congressional jurisdictions and other stakeholders, to really make an effort to collapse them. And typically, you know, a lot of the conversation can orient around how much money we would save by doing it, how much bureaucracy we could eliminate. But I think this conversation, maybe a good way to end it, is like, what may be a smarter way of driving towards a reorg like that is a call to action around a particular problem. Like, the original vision of the SES in government was that it would be fluid and we would move SES, smart SES, to emerging problems and solve them, right? And instead, we mostly have SES that stay in seat for a very long period of time. And you can make the same analogy with government programs. We have, as we've described here, a real opportunity and need to align the smartest thinking, not just so the government can spend money on it or regulate it, but that the government can catalyze these different parts of the economy to share best practices, to think differently about a problem, to convene academia and others towards solutions. So I hope that the president's management agenda, as they're thinking about this, orients around this problem statement and drives synergies to try to solve it. So with that, I think we're out of time, and I want to thank everyone for participating.
This has been a great discussion, and so I want to thank Jen, Beth, and Danny, all of whom are fellows of the Academy, by the way. Make sure we didn't say that in their introduction, but they are, for leading us on a really provocative conversation. So thank you very much. All right, I'm not allowing you to change seats. You have to stay where you are. We're moving to the next portion, which is really what you all came here for today, which is to induct our fellows class of 2018. This ceremony culminates a year-long effort on the part of you, our current fellows, to identify... to nominate, to sponsor, and to vote on an outstanding group of public administrators to add to your ranks. The members of this year's class represent the very best practitioners, academics, and pracademics. They come from all levels of government, and they come from all areas of the country, and they have experiences that span the public, private, and nonprofit sectors. I want to thank all the members of our Fellows Nominating Committee. If you were on the Fellows Nominating Committee, can I ask you to stand? That group was chaired by fellow and board member Dave Mader, who unfortunately can't be with us this afternoon. But they really focused on looking through all of your candidates, looking for the best mix, looking for the best candidates, and giving you a slate that you all carefully considered to bring this class to our attention. And so now I'd like to invite Ann Kadamian up, and she and I are going to preside over the induction of our new class of fellows.
So I'm going to call everyone up one by one and introduce you, and we'll pause here and take a picture on the stage to recognize your induction. All right. Roland Englund, professor and dean of the Maxine Goodman Levin School of College of Urban Affairs, Cleveland State University. Christopher Ansell, Chair, Department of Political Science, University of California, Berkeley. Donald Bathurst, Executive Director, Emergency Preparedness, Department of Homeland Security. Robert Bifolco, Associate Dean, Chair, and Professor, Department of Public Administration and International Affairs, the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at Syracuse University. David Bernuri, Partner, Quarles and Brady. Hector Cordero Guzman, Professor, Marx School of Public and International Affairs, Baroque College of the City University of New York. Lisa Danzig, Specialist Leader, Human Capital, Organizational Talent and Transformation, Deloitte Consulting, LLP. Elaine Duke, Specialist Executive, Deloitte Consulting, LLP. Lee Feldman, former city manager, City of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Okay.
Ron Feldman, Chief Operating Officer, Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Jay Fizette, former board member and chair, Arlington County, Virginia. Myrtle Gotham, Vice President, Research and Innovation, University of Nevada, Reno. Greg Giddens, Partner, Potomac Ridge Consulting, LLC. Thelma Height Harris, President and CEO, Height Consulting Incorporated, and Project Director at the National Academy of Public Administration. Wendy Hayes, Special Assistant to the Vice President for Grants and Advancement Initiatives, Bridgewater State University. James Hendler, Tetherless World Professor and Director, Rensselaer Institute for Data Exploration and Applications, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Robert Lightfoot, President, LSINC. Christopher Liu, Senior Strategy Advisor, Fiscal Note. Deborah Lucas, Director, Gulub Center for Finance and Policy, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Katie Malage, Vice President for Government Effectiveness, Partnership for Public Service. Justin Marlowe, Professor of Public Finance and Civic Engagement, Daniel J. Evans School of Public Policy and Governance, University of Washington. Charles Menefield, Dean, School of Public Affairs and Administration, Rutgers University. Thank you. Inez Mergel, Professor of Public Administration, Department of Politics and Public Administration, University of Konstanz, Germany. Kathleen Miller, Administrative Assistant to the Secretary of the Army, U.S. Army. Christopher Paul Morrill, Executive Director and CEO, Government Finance Officers Association of the United States and Canada. Joseph Nimich, Senior Executive Advisor, Civil and Commercial Group, Booz Allen Hamilton. John Pechkowski, Senior Vice President, Homeland Security and National Resilience, ICF. Courtney Phillips, Executive Commissioner, Texas Health and Human Services Commission. Congratulations. Maureen Pirog, Rudy Professor of Policy Analysis, School of Public and Environmental Affairs, Indiana University. Erica Pothig, Vice President and Chief Innovation Officer, Research to Action Lab, the Urban Institute. Kurt Thurmeier, Professor and Chair, Department of Public Administration in the School of Public and Global Affairs, Northern Illinois University. Eugenia Toma, Wendell H. Professor, Ford Professor of Public Policy and Administration, Martin School of Public Policy and Administration at the University of Kentucky. Janine Valesco, Assistant Director, Business and Management Operations, Fish and Wildlife Service. Okay, Jim. What's that? Oh, okay. Jim Williams, Partner, Shambach and Williams Consulting. Oris Williams Brown, Managing Director, Congressional Relations, U.S. Government Accountability Office. Peter Winokur, founder and president, Integrated Safety Solution, LLC. We have four new fellows who are not able to be here today. If I could just read their names here. Matthew Chase, Chief Executive Officer, National Association of Counties. Michael Ettlinger, Director, Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. Sean Stackley, President, Communications and Network Systems. And Leisha DeHart Davis, Professor of Public Administration and Government at UNC Chapel Hill. Let's recognize them as well.
Okay, go ahead. All right, conscious of the fact that we are standing between you and a reception, I do have one announcement. I'd like to call Charles Minifield up, one of our new fellows, to share an important announcement about next year's Social Equity Leadership Conference.
I'm very excited to let you know that Rutgers University Newark will be the host university for the Social Equity and Leadership Conference next June, more specifically the 5th through the 8th. So you can look forward to receiving an email from me concerning sponsorships and other things. We're very excited to have a nice mix of practitioners as well as academicians talking about the various concepts of social equity and racial equity. So look forward to seeing you in Newark.
Thank you. All right. I hope you've had a great day. It's not done yet. There is a reception in Salon A and B, which we want to invite you all to, unless you're a new fellow, in which case you have to stay here for a group photo, and then you can go to the reception. Be here tomorrow, 8 o'clock for breakfast, 8:30 for the business meeting. We have a lot to talk about, and we invite you all back to hear even more about the exciting new things in the Academy. So thank you again to all our speakers, all our presenters, for a fabulous day, great content, and we look forward to seeing you here in the salon for the reception and here in the morning at 8 o'clock. Thank you.
Back here.
Here we go.
Yeah.
think this is going to work.
We may not be in the picture.
We'll tell you.
That's right.
You need to be to this side of the podium.
Are you kidding?
Nobody on that side of the podium.
So far, you're good.
Put two fingers above your head?
Absolutely.
Four would be better.
One would probably be the right answer.
Yeah.
One strategic finger.
Done.
Chris, I noticed you're at the Miller Center. Is that this just the last year?
Since the last year and a half, since the end of the administration. I don't know if you've been in the news a lot more lately than we should.
That's the main reason I'm
who knew a boring, relatively boring research presentation would actually, generate that much?
The guy that was the center of it is still there. Right?
Yeah, Mark Short, that legendary guy. I didn't. And it's unfortunate. There are obviously very strong people who use it. Much of it was designed, which is unfortunate. The Institute, the center does such great research. I think they generally don't like to be in the news.
Well, we only make sense about it because you never know if the guys have it.
Okay.
Say, I'm like my mom.
Embodied.